Looking for a football show with a bit of a twist?
So I know the likes of Griezmann's big into his fashion.
He wanted a lot. One question he actually asked me was, could he make his studs light up when he runs?
Team 33, the football magazine show for the football purists.
Yeah, the Nike Mercurials from 1998, if you just show that boot to an entire generation of people, and they just get instantly nostalgic and remember everything from that era.
The very best interviews with the cult heroes of the past, and a look at the cultural side of football. Team 33, live at 9 p.m. every Friday on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoff and Heskey.
Back to this Saturday's Off the Ball. Neil Tracy with you until 5 o'clock this evening. Time now for OTB Football Saturday. We are streaming live across the OTB social platforms at Off the Ball and on the OTB Sports app as well. Get your text into us on 53106. Liverpool fans, we're obviously going to be discussing your title victory a bit more. What does it mean to you? Is this the end of one journey and just the beginning of another? A reminder as well, all of our football coverage is brought to you by Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewy.net. And I'm joined for the next couple of hours by Daniel McDonald, soccer correspondent for the Irish Independent, as well as former Irish international Damien Delaney. Gents, thanks a million for joining us today.
Thanks, Neil.
So, guys, only one place to start, really. Premier League title officially wrapped up on Thursday night, even though it probably was sorted since probably December, really. But I don't know. I'm not a Liverpool fan. I have to say, it pains me to say I did take... There was something quite enjoyable about the scenes. We were probably all a bit worried what things were going to be like, seeing celebrations when, you know, no fans are at games and stuff like that. But it's all about the journey, isn't it? It's all about the 30 years. It's about that narrative. And I couldn't help but feel happy for quite a few people, for friends, for people I know, for when you see like Kenny Dalglish on BT Sport and Sky Sports the other night. I mean, the man was just emotionally broken almost. It had been such a long time for him to sit back and watch. But Liverpool, the champions, let's get your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I did enjoy watching the Kenny Dalglish contributions, all right, because he is probably, he embodies the journey in many respects. And there is no doubt, you know, whatever your view on Liverpool, that the story of, you know, how it ended in 1990 is a pretty powerful one. And, you know, a while back I did a piece speaking to some of the Irish players who were there at the time, the fringe players, you know, sort of Mark Kenny and Tony Cousins and Davy Collins, John Carroll, like four Irish lads who were there around 1990, who, like a lot of people at that stage, were just used to Liverpool winning the league. Those that were there didn't even remember too much about, you know, the celebrations or anything, because the atmosphere in Liverpool at the time, it was just another win. But at the same time, there was obviously, they were very conscious that post Hillsborough, there was a change of mood around the club. And you know, Kenny Dalglish obviously was struggling with that. And there's no doubt that all of that was a massive factor in his decision to leave. And, you know, in that respect, like, there's massive emotion in the success. There's massive emotion, you know, for the people of Liverpool. There's no doubt of that, you know, because they really feel that story. You know, they've lived it. And there was always going to be an outpouring of celebration. I'm always very conscious of just generalizing with football fans in every sense, because it's dangerous. Clearly, you know, some of the celebrations have gone way overboard and probably, you know, been pretty unfortunate. But like that, you know, I mean, if you have a massive fan base, like, there's possibly always going to be an element of that, and that is regrettable. But in terms of just the symbolism of what they've achieved and what it means to, like, people who really feel the 1990 aspect of it, that's absolutely huge. I mean, I don't have any love for, but I don't have any love for any Premier League club, and it doesn't really bother me who wins it. I don't really buy into the outside attachment to it, but I get that it means something to a lot of people. We've seen a lot of outpouring of joy from a lot of happy middle-aged Irish men, you know, this week. from the GA writing fraternity and other areas of the business who have a just unbelievable connection and love with Liverpool that almost reduces them back to their you know, teenage self. And listen, it's not for me, but it's something for a lot of people.
Damien, your thoughts on it? How did you feel watching it all on Thursday night?
I was delighted, like truly delighted for Liverpool. It's a fantastic story. It's a fantastic an ending to it. And with the COVID-19 fiasco where they had to wait an extra period of time, even though we all knew they were only champions elect, it just added a great kind of a better feel to it for me, to be honest with you. Obviously, Dan spoke there fantastically about, you know, what it means to all the Liverpool people who had to wait 30 years. But I found myself the last couple of days thinking, it's eerily similar to what Manchester United are going to go through or going through at the minute. And I remember, I think it was Kenny Dalglish said on Thursday night that when they last won the league, he never ever envisaged that it would be 30 years. And I think if we said something similar now to Manchester United, you know, maybe 30 years is a bit harsh. You know, so I know I'm probably going to upset a lot of Man United fans. You know, I'm not a Liverpool fan, I'm not a Man United fan. But it's just eerily similar. And I think Man United have just lost their way a little bit. And they have such a fantastic period over the last number of years that they need to do some serious rebuilding as well. And look at it, the type of character it took in Jurgen Klopp coming in to take a club that was kind of a little bit, I won't say a little bit of a mess, but, you know, they were searching and they had the added pressure of having to wait 30 years. And look at his personality and what he's done to bring the whole city together. And he's such a likeable fella as well. I mean, if you play for him or you're playing against him or you're just watching him, he says all the right things. He's a thoroughly decent man. And I'm really happy for him and I'm really happy for the people at Liverpool. But I just found myself yesterday drifting off thinking about the similarities at Man United.
On that though, is football so different now that we probably wouldn't see a gap for someone like Man United for as long as that, because it probably is a lot easier these days to just go out and buy a title at some point. If United were to get maybe, you know, 12, 13 years down the line, they haven't done it. Do they kind of just think, right, let's just pump the money in here and go for it?
But I don't think Man United can compete anymore. You know, you've got teams that are state-backed. And Man United in the 90s were pretty much the wealthiest club in the UK. And then if they wanted to, they could just go out and buy the best players. They did it all the time. They went to Leeds and took Cantona, York, Cole. You know, if someone had a good season, they just went in and took the best players. They haven't got that financial muscle anymore. And other teams aren't, you know, as desperate to sell. You know, you look at today's market, Man United just go and buy Harry Kane. I know. I remember Roy Keane said something similar, just go and buy him. It's going to cost you $200-300 million. You know, back in the day, it was 20 or 30. So I think that Man United have kind of faltered a little bit and they've fallen behind and got themselves in a little bit of a mess with a lot of players there that shouldn't be there on contracts they shouldn't be on. They're not going to be able to shift them. And Man United just can't pour the money in like, say, Manchester City or, you know, if Newcastle get taken over by the Saudi crowd, then, you know, I just don't think Man United can compete financially with them, and it's not as easy to do what they did in the 90s.
Dan, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to know. I mean, they still obviously are still a massive global operation, Manchester United, but that can change pretty quickly. I mean, I guess, you know, prior to what, 1993, they'd had their own long famine. I think I saw someone refer to that in the coverage in the last couple of days that I think actually it might be in the Simon Hughes piece about Liverpool, actually, or maybe it was somewhere else, actually. It might be a piece in the Examiner, actually. But, you know, referring to, you know, how it was almost unthinkable I think Liverpool fans in 1993 almost that a club could go that long, and then look what happened to them. So I guess it can happen to anyone. I see what Damien's saying. I certainly, because I don't subscribe to this theory. I mean, I know the lad spoke about it last week that that Manchester United, like, have you know, they've got Bruno Fernandes and Pogba now, and they're finishing the season strong, and maybe they're going to challenge next year. I'm not having that at all, really. I think that's the classic, you know, it's like people watch horse racing sometimes and they see a horse finishing the race fast and they think he's going to win the next day, but like he's miles behind, you know. Like they're like, it's always deceptive. You think, oh, they might have turned the corner. Like they have a massive points gap to build, and certainly, you know, it does seem like, you know, structurally the club has a long way to go. I'm not sure if it'll be that long though, purely because I think the slight difference that you have now is that the Premier elite, you know, the big change in recent years, it's something I wouldn't be mad about, is even the top four, five, six clubs, they get a greater share of the TV revenue. The Premier League used to be a lot more evenly distributed. Like, the super clubs now call the shots. I mean, for all the romance around Liverpool, they are one of the super clubs. Like, they're in a pretty strong position, along with Man City and the other real powerhouses. And you need almost someone to do a Newcastle-style, like Man City style, sort of fairly questionable spend out of nowhere to blow into that, to really blow into that territory. So actually, and we don't know where Man City are going to go with fair play. So part of me thinks, and this is why I think Liverpool have a great chance of winning multiple titles, because you're thinking, well, who's actually going to really rival them over the next period of time? Like, Liverpool were in a position a couple of years ago where they had to sell players, like, that they were always vulnerable to losing, or not that they had to sell, but it just, they didn't have the appeal maybe to hold on to, you know, a Suarez or even a Coutinho more recently if a certain club came in looking for them. I think now Liverpool is in a very strong financial footing. It's where people want to go. And you know, if Man City are affected by these changes, I don't see anyone really competing with them. But invariably, actually, I still think that in maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 years' time, it probably could still be a Manchester United that actually up emerges as the threat. I just don't see it happening in the short term.
All right.
But Dan, on what you say there, that, like, and I do agree with a little bit of what you said. It took a Jurgen Klopp type figure to come in and spend very, very little money. I think the net spend is somewhere in and around 100 million. And they had a lot of assets that they were able to offload and make money on. I know because Crystal Palace took Christian Benteke and Mamadou Sakho for the guts of 50 or 60 million. He was able to offload those players, but it took a man of his personality and his charisma and his aura to walk in the door and have that feel about him of, I'm going to change the direction of this club. I'm going to change the direction of everything. And I'm the man that's going to do it. I just don't feel that with Solskjaer in charge, he has that in him. You know, there's a lot of players there. Could Man United move them? Possibly. They could make a little bit of money. But they need to be very, very shrewd in the transfer market as well. And I know that when Jurgen Klopp took that Liverpool job, he got the whole club on the same page. And the page was his page. Okay, these are the players that I want. This is the profile of the players that I want. These are the players that I want to get rid of, whether they were good or bad. I mean, a lot of people say that, you know, Coutinho was a loss, but what he replaced them with the goalkeeper and Van Dijk, he made them better. Man United, I don't see the ownership, boardroom, director of football, or manager. I don't see them all on the same page. The club is operating a little bit independently, and I'd say there's things happening behind the scenes of that club that Solskjaer's not a part of. Whereas I don't think there's anything happens at Liverpool, and I mean nothing, that Jurgen Klopp isn't on top of. And I'd say the director of football and the ownership there phone Jurgen Klopp before they make any decision, anything from transfers to you know, changing the chef at the training ground. I mean, he will be in and all of that, and I just don't see Solskjaer having that type of personality, that type of charisma. And I think that Man United at the minute are not going to spend their way out of this. They've tried that for the last number of years. They've spent an unholy amount of money. They're not going to do it. They need to get someone in with charisma, with personality, that's going to lift the football club on its back, turn it around and say, right, we're going in this direction, and just take the whole thing with them. With regard to the second point you made there, Dan, about who's going to challenge them, I think Manchester City, it's going to be, you know, Man United, Arsenal of the 90s for the next number of years. I don't think there's anyone else going to get in there. I think we're going to look for some fantastic title races the next 2-3 years. Liverpool have put themselves in a fantastic position financially. They have an awful lot of money to spend now because their net spend is so low. Their income is going to go through the roof with this Premier League win. So I think they're definitely going to be there for the next 4, 5, 6 years, or as long as Jurgen wants to stay. And I think, you know, all things being equal and Man City get away with this financial fair play thing, I think we're in for a good kind of neck and neck tough tussle there between these two for the next number of years, and I'm looking forward to it.
Right.
Yeah, I think. I think you want to cut me off a bit, Neil, but I just think like that depends on Pep, though, I think, as well, and how all things play out. Because I think we're on the same page about Ole, Damien. Like, I don't think they're going. I think it's, you know, I think you do need a comparable, like, you know, with Klopp and Pep, they both took time at their respective clubs to get where they wanted to be. And I just think that with Pep, the question is, when push comes to shove and if things go against them with UEFA, is he prepared to tough it out? Because if not, I don't think anyone else is going to challenge them in the short term.
All right. Well, I was just trying to jump in there, Dan, because we actually have one of your colleagues on as well. You made a joke a few minutes ago, maybe, about how it seems almost every GA writer in the country is a Liverpool fan.
It's true. It's completely true.
Not specifically a GA writer, covers everything, but your chief sports writer, Vincent Hogan's on the line. Because, Vincent, I know you're a big Liverpool fan. The reason I have you on today, you were on a pay-per-view with us last year, and you spoke about watching this current Liverpool team with your son. And you're somebody I thought about the other day, because you did speak brilliantly at the time about just how much it meant to you to be able to watch this current Liverpool team with your son and be able to enjoy that experience together.
Yeah, Neil, I suppose it's one of the things that's allowed me have a real connection with my youngest son. And, you know, the connection I have with my older son is motorsport. And, you know, I did a lot of rallying when I was younger, and he used to come on the service van and he loved it. And the two of us also worked as marshals at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix a couple of times. But with my youngest son, and I brought all my kids to Anfield over the years trying to give them this, what felt like a sickness for a long time. And my two eldest son and my eldest daughter, they just really weren't interested at all. But my youngest son has absolutely bought into this thing. And what it does to you is you feel an incredible sense of privilege that your son actually supports the team because you did. It seems like a lovely, almost loving thing for him to do. But also, you feel this, and I can actually say, a profound sense of guilt when you see the bad days and what it does to him. And over the years, you know, listen to the two lads there talking about Klopp and just the sheer size of his personality and what he has brought to the club. You know, it's easy to forget that it's only 10 years ago there was a genuine fear of the club going into administration, and there was a real basket case under Hicks and Gillette. So when I hear, say, Dan there talking about the possibility of multiple titles coming down the tracks, I feel uncomfortable, I suppose, because it's just such a special time to be a Liverpool fan. You have, in my lifetime, probably the most beautiful football team we've ever had. All these magnificent players, but above all, the personality of the manager, who just never seems to put a foot wrong. And it just seems such a precious time. I'm really apprehensive when people talk about them hosing up titles for the next few years.
Yeah, you mentioned, I suppose, the man everyone's been talking about, Jurgen Klopp, there a couple of moments ago, because I think for a lot of the neutrals who are feeling a lot of kind of happiness for Liverpool fans, it's probably someone like him is the reason for it, because he just seems like such a good football coach and a good football brain for a start, but a thoroughly decent guy and an excellent man manager on top of it. And just bringing up the article you wrote yesterday in the Irish Independent, like the headline, "Both godlike and human, Jurgen Klopp has rebuilt a team and a club on fundamental decency." And it's just a great summarisation, I suppose, of what Jurgen Klopp has done to Liverpool, not just the club, but the city, I suppose, as well, over the last 4.5 years.
I'll give you an example, Neil. I'm 40 years a sports writer now, and I've often joked that my wife is so uninterested in sport that I could tell her I'm off to the Olympics for 3 weeks and go down to Lahinch and play golf for the 3 weeks, and she'd never bother checking the paper to see was I even in it. But she actually comes to a stop whenever Klopp appears on television, because of this charisma the man has. And I watch her watching him, and she's just smiling. And we were actually talking about this last night. What is it? And I know Damien was talking about the force of his personality. But even supporters of United and supporters of Chelsea and supporters even of City, you talk to them, and they really like Klopp. And they really like the way he communicates himself, what he stands for, his the fact that he always has conviction in him. And I think that's what Damien was getting at there, that we saw the likes of a Roy Hodgson being completely lost when he was Liverpool manager because he didn't have the personality for the job. He didn't understand the passion, the wicked humour, the bitterness, I suppose, that is in that humour in Liverpool and what they've been through as a city. And I think it's extraordinary to me that a German could have gone in there and just tapped into that psychology so quickly, so easily. Like, bear in mind, he was only 6 months manager when he was offered a new contract by Fenway because they just saw that, yeah, this guy gets it. And, you know, obviously they had to start winning eventually, but I remember saying to someone, you know, when it looked like, you know, they lost the semi-final 3-0 in Barcelona of the Champions League last season, and someone said to me, I was at one of my daughter's matches, and they said, God, another trophy-less year for Klopp. And I actually instinctively turned on him because I just thought, what a lot of garbage, you know, to actually just judge this man on whether he could win a Champions League or a title. When you think of how difficult it is to win a title in this moneyed age of football and how 97 points wasn't enough last year, I just was besotted with his personality and what he was bringing to the club and the likability factor that he was bringing to the club, because that was missing for far too long.
Do you remember what your thoughts would have been back in October 2015 when he got the job?
I remember I was in America, and firstly when I heard that Rodgers was gone, I was slightly gutted. I liked Rodgers. I thought he was a really creative, innovative coach. But one thing that always struck me about Rodgers was that he always seemed to have a very dry mouth in press conferences. You know, he always prefaced every sentence was, as I said, even when he hadn't said it. And there was a nervousness in Rodgers that while he had this great ability as a coach, and we saw it with what he did with Sterling, we saw it with Coutinho, who really flourished under him, we saw what he got out of Suarez and Sturridge as a partnership. But when the moment they lost that momentum after the near miss and Gerrard slip and all of that, the following season, when they lost the momentum, he didn't have the personality to carry that loss of momentum. And, you know, he ended up sacking his coach. He ended up looking to sign Christian Benteke, which was an absolute short-term thing. He might get goals for us. He didn't want Firmino, for example, at the time, whereas it was Mike Edwards who wanted Firmino. So they kind of compromised and brought in the two. When Klopp came in, I knew he had this CV of, you know, winning Bundesligas and getting to a Champions League final and that he had a great personality. But to be honest, I just didn't know how this was going to work. I didn't understand how big his personality was and just the scale of his charisma.
What sort of a Liverpool fan are you? Because I've always thought that there are two categories of Liverpool fans. There is the eternal optimist, the this is our year every single mid-August, and then there's also the eternal pessimist, which is I've just been afflicted with this, you know, this disease of supporting Liverpool, as you kind of joked about as well at the start. Where do you fall in there?
Oh, I'm the pessimist. I'm the eternal pessimist. And that's why I say I'm apprehensive when I hear Dan talking about plenty more titles to come. I mean, I became a Liverpool fan in 1971. And it was kind of a perfect storm for me in that I used to go to All-Ireland finals in the 60s and sit on my father's lap when Tipperary, when kind of they won 4 out of 5 All-Irelands in the early 60s. And then they won again in 71. And there was this sense of, you know, I always imagined would be at All-Ireland finals. But then Tip, they got to a Munster final in 73 and then they fell off the face of the earth. And, you know, you're a young fella in Nina in Tipperary, and I remember the thing that sold me on Liverpool was Steve Highway, and it was coming up to the 71 Cup final, and there was a feature on television about this really unorthodox football story. This guy who hadn't been, you know, spotted by any of the top amateur clubs over in England. He was an economics student, and he was about to graduate in 1970 when Liverpool decided to take him from Skelmersdale United. And like within 5 months, he was playing top-flight football, and he was this beautiful, elegant footballer And I always loved the idea of a winger called Highway. It was just a magical thing to me. And, of course, the fact that he was an Irish international as well just added to it. So really the thing for me was I started following Liverpool in 71. Within 2 years, they were league champions. They won the FA Cup in 74. And it was just a glory period forevermore then. But once that stopped happening, I often wondered, would we ever get back to winning a title again, particularly when you saw the money coming into the game, the cities and the Chelseas, and like we see Abramovich at Chelsea now seems to be interested again. They've started buying these world-class players. So I'm always, well, I have always been a pessimist, but it's very hard to be a pessimist in the age of Klopp.
Certainly is, yeah. Finally then as well, you obviously mentioned your son and, you know, you passed on, as we joked, what you call this disease to them. Did you ever regret doing that down the years when things were bleak? Did you ever just think, God, why didn't I pick up a different shirt? Or was it Liverpool or nobody else?
Oh, no, look, I've always loved the fact that he's followed me as a Liverpool fan, if you like. But, yeah, I'll always remember in 2014, the night of the 3-all draw with Crystal Palace, I was working on Henry Shefflin's book at the time, and I was actually down in Wexford, and around midnight, my wife sent me a text, "What on earth have you done?" And I just, what on earth have I done? And she explained to me that Matty was in the front room absolutely inconsolable. And I felt such an intense level of guilt at that moment. But you know something, like, he's 22 now, and we try to get over to a match every year. We go up to the same pub, the Prince Harry. We have our few pints. And it's just something that I absolutely treasure, that day out that we give ourselves every year, a few pints before the game and after the game. And it's just a lovely connection to have. And even through the bad times, it was a lovely connection to have. But right now, I'm telling you, Neil, it's just such a wonderful time to be a Liverpool supporter.
Damien Delaney, any chance you'd like to publicly apologise to Vincent Hogan's son for 2014?
the highs wouldn't be as high if the lows weren't so low. So I gave it a nice little low there, and that's where you've enjoyed his high.
Exactly. Yeah. You played your part in the journey as well, Damien. You played your part in the journey as well. Vincent, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, and hope you have enjoyed the celebrations over the last few days.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks, lads. Take care.
That's Vincent Hogan there, chief sports writer for the Irish Independent. We'll have more on OTB Football Saturday coming up with Dan McDonnell and Damien Delaney after the break.
Missing this?
I remember Ollie texted me Solskjaer. One or two people would get hold of my number, unfortunately, and he would text me.
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoffin Heskey.
Yes, you're very welcome back to Off the Ball this Saturday. We are currently in the middle of OTB Football Saturday. Dan McDonnell and Damien Delaney have joined me on Skype for the afternoon. A reminder as well, we're streaming across all of our social channels at the moment. Just go to @offtheball across any of our social channels or check us out on the OTB Sports app. Get your texts into us as well on 53106. We'll be talking more about Liverpool and going forward, can they create this dynasty now and, you know, add title number 20, 21, 22 over the coming years? Who knows? And also as well, later on in the football hours, we will be discussing events here at home, how we're going to restart the League of Ireland, and I suppose a recap of the last couple of weeks since the Premier League resumed. But Dan and Damien, before Vincent came on the line there a short while ago, we were talking really about what Liverpool have to do now over the next few years to make sure that this isn't just title number 19 and everyone catches up to them. Damien, you know, both of you kind of got the impression it probably is going to be a two-horse race pretty much over the next few years. If Liverpool are to go on and push on now, where do they actually need to improve?
For me, I think for them to compete in Europe year in, year out, and to win Premier League, they need a touch more creativity in midfield. The midfield three is very, very functional. It's very, very... I'm not for a second saying that they're not top players, Jordan Henderson is fantastic at what he does. So is Gini Wijnaldum and Fabinho and Oxlade-Chamberlain. They're kind of the main four that are in and around it. When you look at teams like Manchester City, you know, who have a David Silva, a real, and that's where they, I won't say they got found out, but where they kind of got caught a little bit against Atletico Madrid, where they didn't have someone to open up. That now that might require a shift in style, because while, you know, the biggest strength is that functionality, the high press, the 100 miles an hour tempo that they set, it is always that midfield three. So if they're to evolve, and I'm pretty sure the Jurgen Klopp will have thought of this, that they have to evolve, they have to improve, they have to get better, and it might require a certain shift in style. So it'll be interesting to see where he takes it, but that is certainly one area straight away. If they could get in a scheme or a proper little player that can unlock really, really tough defences, that would make them instantly better.
Yeah, that is the tricky one, Dan. If you're to add that bit of star power into midfield, do you run the risk of losing a little bit of what is actually a really, really good and functional midfield at the moment?
Yeah, no, it's a valid point. I mean, I think sometimes there can be a sensitivity in being critical about this Liverpool side, and, you know, and admitting that they might actually have some improvement to do. Like, I would actually view it as nearly a positive from their perspective, like that they still have that. You know, like you even look in the last 2 years, and I think where that creativity and maybe that midfield quality, it's probably shown in some of their like away European games, where they've been found wanting. And like, it's funny, Vincent even refers to the Barcelona game, you know, where they get turned over and then they have this incredible performance at home. But like, there have been like away performances at times where they have lacked that. Like, they are not the finished article. In Europe this year, listen, I don't think it was their main priority really. It was about winning the league. But still, you know, there was just, they showed that they weren't perfect. And like, again, it's not taken away from their achievement to point out that the Premier League probably hasn't been that strong this year. Like, the top two are exceptionally good, and when City dropped off, Liverpool had to win it because no one else was going to. Now, their points per game is incredible. You know, the number of points that they've sort of accumulated, the points they haven't dropped, like, it's a massive achievement. But like, you know, they would have expected to win it if you thought that City were going to have a slightly, you know, to be slightly below par, because they're that good. But they can get better. In a strange way, I think what they need to do, like, it's more of a psychological thing. Like, they need to almost retain that sort of relentless streak that they have as well. Like, which, you know, that sort of, which makes them so hard for teams to play against. And they've always been like pursuing something, this Liverpool side. It was almost a sense of, like, I did wonder last year when they had the narrow miss in the league that would have almost deflate them. But if anything, they just carried the momentum. It's almost like a two-season story wrapped into one, where they've won the Champions League and the league in almost this one big long season, where they've managed to bridge one to the next. But now they've got to the top of the mountain. I think, like, that's why people are so impressed and so confident about their ability to stay there. It's probably because of the manager that they have with Klopp, that you look at him and he seems to be to have that right balance of being popular with the players but demanding with the players, that it's hard to see them switching off. Like, sometimes, like, Man City have won, like, what, they would have been going for a fifth title, but they almost used to win it every second year for a while until they won the last two. And I think sometimes it was just a club, like, huge amount of money going round. I'm not sure if they had the desire to really just keep going, or maybe the managers that were there, you know, had more of a shelf life and they weren't enamoured with Mancini really, and so on. Whereas here there seems to be a stability, but still it's a bit of an unknown when you defend. Like, they should be fine. There's no reason why they shouldn't be fine. You look at the solid characters that are there and you think that they should be. But it's almost about, like, there's the improvement in that area of the pitch. But I think it's just maintaining that intensity when you are suddenly now the champions, and just, you know, like, can you sustain that over a couple of years when every single week it must be mentally draining to be asked for that, never mind the physical side, but even mentally, just to maintain that effort.
Yeah, I'm just going to play a little video, because one man who isn't with us this week, Johnny Ward, he was on last week, and he's been getting a fair bit of stick from Liverpool fans on our Off the Ball Twitter page this morning, because the clip doing the rounds from last Saturday, when is Johnny questioning actually the pedigree of this Liverpool side?
Just on the point there, JD, you made in terms of, that Kenny made in terms of Manchester United being contenders next season. I think that's a very, very real prospect, because you mentioned obviously the Man City situation, but I've made the point. I genuinely think Liverpool have been a bit overrated this season in that they didn't do well in Europe. I think they have a very functional midfield, and I think they won a league that was fairly disappointing. And I think Manchester United have the ingredients to really give Liverpool a right good shot at the next season. For all that, Liverpool should be favourites.
5-3-1-6. Liverpool overrated, beaten by a goalkeeping error against a fine Atletico team. One loss and one draw so far. Overrated. Wow. Johnny?
Yeah, but I've had this debate a million times. You know, I said that I expected it. I remember having a debate with Phil Thompson about this. I thought they lost to Atletico and Napoli in the Champions League, two fairly bang average teams. Now they were knocked out against Atletico primarily because they didn't have their goalkeeper. I'll admit that. But I thought in Europe this season, and to an extent last season as well, even though they won the thing, I thought like Liverpool are a very, very functional team in terms of their midfield. They get the ball to the front three. They have the best centre back in the world by a stretch. They've one of the best goalkeepers in the world. They've two excellent right backs, but there are flaws in that Liverpool team, and I think they've been outstanding champions. But I would have liked to have seen a Man City team that was far more at it. Man City were, you know, they played Liverpool earlier in the season in the first game at Anfield and were favourites to beat them at Anfield. So that's where they were. That's where the markets expected Liverpool. They said Liverpool were comfortably inferior to Manchester City according to the markets early in the season. They have won the league. They had an amazing ability to win games that maybe they shouldn't have. I thought in a lot of the big games this season they showed frailties, and I can have this argument all day long. I thought Liverpool were overrated in terms of their points tally. As a pound for pound, that Man United team isn't a million miles off them next season, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Johnny is in Roy Keane light mode again. Great to have the football back.
Naturally, guys, Liverpool fans have taken all that in their stride.
I mean, where do you even start with that? Like, I mean, like Johnny said, he could have that argument a million times and he'd be wrong a million times. I mean, you know, he said they're an overrated team, but then when they list several world-class players, you know, I mean, I don't even know what to say. I like Johnny, he's a great lad, but I mean, he's obviously a Man United fan and he's pretty upset that Liverpool are champions. But look,
he's not. Johnny has said it plenty of times. Johnny grew up a Liverpool fan.
No, listen, then I don't know. Then I'm not. Maybe the isolation's got to him because of that. I'm not sure about that rant there. Listen, they're by far and away the best team in the Premier League. There are improvements in them. Dan made an excellent point there earlier that, I spoke about the lack of creativity, but maintaining the work ethic and the level of performance, because physically playing for Jurgen Klopp it would be very, very difficult. I remember when my last year speaking to people, you know, their training regime, the numbers they put up are really, really high. So, you know, they'll be looking for a drop off from players for that high press, that high tempo game. So that'll be a worry for him, but Jurgen Klopp will be right on top of that. He'll be well aware of what needs doing, which players look like they're about to have a drop off, whether he wants to change his style up. You know, he's in complete control. I can guarantee he's six transfer windows ahead, or is thinking about, you know, six transfer, which is 3 years time, where he wants to be and the type of squad and the type of football he wants to have. And like I said, they're in a fantastic position financially. So as long as Jurgen Klopp stays interested and wants to stay there, I don't see Liverpool ever being outside the top two for the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I will defend Johnny a small bit, and like I rarely do that, to be fair, but you know, I can sort of see what he was getting at, but then he threw in a couple of lines that are very Johnny's always good for like a good quote headline, you know, but like I don't think overrated or anything like that. I can't subscribe to that. And I've said I don't think Manchester United are going to challenge them next year at all. But I think, you know, just the point about how like the feel that they faced this year, like it wasn't a vintage Premier League season. I don't think you can really claim that. I think a lot of teams are going through a transition period, or they've had a down year, but still, like, Liverpool ruthlessly exposed it, and like they would have won it, I think, in most years with that level of performance, really, you know. But it is still something, though. Yeah, the point about pressing on from here, and that's where the personality comes into it. I'm repeating myself a bit, but sometimes, like, I've spoken to players involved in the game and involved in sports, that if they have a very demanding manager, like, who really demands something of them. Like, sometimes there's a shelf life with it, but he seems to have a strength of personality that the players enjoy it, that the regime they operate in. And sometimes others, like, the reason some regimes burn out is because there is just literally a burnout from that for a period of time. But you would think, you know, the charisma and the overall ability he has will offset that. But I see where Johnny was getting at, but I mean, yeah, maybe a slight exaggeration in tone. But he wasn't exactly wild talk in terms of some aspects of it either.
If you want to find out what true friendship is, it is Dan McDonald right there, because if Johnny Ward was on this line, you probably would have torn strips out of him. But when he's not here, you'll stand up for your man.
I mean, I really won't, to be honest. I would happily dig him most times, you know. And I just think, like, he's getting pelters today over that clip. And I listen, the Liverpool fan base can be pretty sensitive at times, like most, you know.
Oh,
like most,
Dan, stop. Dan, you can't. No, listen. You did your best to defend him there.
Listen, I'm not labouring the point. I think, like, overrated, I mean, I just, you can't say that about a team that's actually just winning at the moment, you know, like winning a lot and winning well. And I think maybe he's placing too much scope in some of the European games in the group stages when it wasn't their priority. I don't think that can be the barometer for form, you know, for their actual form, because the league was the priority this year.
I'm not sure where he sees Man United, you know.
Oh, no, I'm
Liverpool.
Not having that at all. I'm not having that part of it. No chance.
I mean, that's, you know, there was a lot of white. Fair enough, you can see through a lot of what and pick the bones out of what Johnny was trying to say, but, like, he lost me, you know, after 2 seconds in that clip there.
my favourite line, though, it had to be just the line, "I can have this argument all day long," which I think will actually... You can put it on Johnny Ward's gravestone the day he dies.
You just can't. There's some fan bases you just can't go there with. I found this. Liverpool are up there. Celtic, you know, there's a few others. It can be a difficult debate to... If you get into that debate, it's very hard to get out of it. Like, I mean, I always love this angle of the long-suffering Liverpool supporter. Like, I know you touched on it with Vincent earlier on. Like, you know, they I know it's been 30 years of hurt since they haven't won the league, but, like, they've won a couple of European Cups in that time, an FA Cup, a UEFA Cup. A lot of people would have taken those 30 years, but there's obviously there's different degrees of pain and what they've been through in terms of the struggle, you know. But they definitely, now that they've got to the summit, they don't like anyone suggesting that this team may not be the best of all time. Like, I think they've got a way to go to earn that status, because I think you retain something to really get to that level. But Johnny's tone obviously went a bit to the other end of that scale.
Plenty of texts coming in here as well on 53106, and keep them coming as well. This one: "I became a Liverpool fan in the same year as Vincent Hogan, 1971, when my mother collected a load of Stork margarine wrappers and sent away for the jerseys that were on special offer. My brother got a Chelsea jersey, and I'm delighted to say I got an adult-sized Liverpool jersey with the sleeves touching the ground, but I wore it with pride as I tucked into the huge supply of apple tarts that my mum has made with all that margarine." That is from Peter in Cork. And on, I suppose, back onto Liverpool here, I'm a diehard, and the link with Man United, I suppose, is what we were talking about, and could they end up doing a Liverpool now and having to wait a long, long time? "I'm a diehard United fan since 79, but we haven't a hope of winning a league next year because of the lack of a killer manager, brackets Klopp/Fergie, killer midfielder, brackets Keane, or most importantly, a killer goal scorer, brackets Van Nistelrooy. One of the three would do, particularly the latter." That's from Owen. This texter here: "Liverpool had a Leicester season in the league. Poor standard from other teams. Big teams not up to it from early on. Liverpool, a good side, yes, but far from the best Premier League team." I would definitely take issue with the "by far from the best Premier League team" if they're 23 points clear with 7 games to go.
I assume he means ever, though. Does he? Does he mean ever? I'd assume... I'm being kind to the texter there, because I think, like, there's obviously discussions, are they the best... one of the best Premier League winners? I'm guessing so. I don't know.
Okay, well, give him the benefit of the doubt on that one, but still, yeah. a Leicester season, I'm not sure you can agree with that.
Well, I don't think you can go that far, but obviously, like, when Leicester won the league, the point was made that, well, a lot of teams were in transition at that time or going through a tough year, which they were. And like, I mean, there's not, like, you look at this, you go through the field this year, like Man City were below their standards. You know, Arsenal and Spurs both changed their managers. Man U are way off it. You know, you've got a Champions League race that's wide mm-hmm. open. Like Leicester should probably qualify for the Champions League. You've got Wolves, who I think are very good. Mm-hmm. You even had Sheffield United around the premises as well. So it would suggest that the strength in depth isn't there. Like I made the point the other day mm-hmm. in a piece. I mean, Liverpool won the Champions League in 2005 when they came fifth. I think they were sort of like 30-something points behind yeah. Chelsea. That was that brilliant Chelsea team. You know, the Mourinho's best Chelsea team. But they were unstoppable that year in the league. And yet you had like a Liverpool team that came fifth that mm-hmm. was able to win the Champions League. There's no way a team 30-something points behind Liverpool this year could threaten for a Champions League. So it's not as strong a Premier League at the moment. There's no disputing that.
Sorry to cut you off there, Dan. We do have to take a quick ad break, though, but more with Dan and Damien Delaney after the break.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off The Ball.
When he wants to do something, he does it. A hugely impressive person, apart from being obviously a brilliant golfer.
My cousins disliked their dog so intensely that they renamed it Scalacci.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the dog was called Scalacci from then on.
It's a great piece of journalism, but that sums up what he's like. The intro to this is just brilliant. He is an absolute control freak.
Digesting the best stories on the back pages every Sunday afternoon on Off The Ball.
All right, you're very welcome back to Off The Ball this Saturday. Neil Tracy with you for another hour up until 5 o'clock. We are in the middle of OTB Football Saturday, where we're streaming across all of Off The Ball's social platforms as well and on the OTB Sports app. I'm joined by Daniel McDonald, soccer correspondent for the Irish Independent, as well as former Irish international Damien Delaney. Plenty of texts and tweets coming in, lads, over the last 5-6 minutes while we were away in ads and news. Man United will not be challengers next season, and Liverpool aren't overrated. They're the best team of the Premier League era. Dez says, in my opinion, this Liverpool side isn't the best in history. When you compare the starting 11, you could go with either keeper. I'd pick both Liverpool fullbacks, Virgil van Dijk and Mane. Then everyone else, including bench, I'd go with City. Liverpool, I believe, are in the top 5 starting 11s in Europe, but I wouldn't consider them the best team in England. However, they are by far the most informed team in the world. Another texter, if this was a poor Premier League season, why didn't Man City get closer? Wolves and Sheffield United stepped up. United and Arsenal were rubbish last year too, but nobody was saying it was a weak Premier League. The begrudgers need to get over themselves.
I completely agree with that, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, you can't say there's a poor Premier League season. You know, the points per game ratio is massive. They deserve every bit of credit they get. They can only beat what's put in front of them. I don't think Liverpool really care where you put them in the pantheon of great Premier League teams. You know, they've got what they've got. They've won their Premier League. They're in a great position to go on and dominate English football for the next number of years. The club is really extremely well run off the pitch. It's extremely well run on the pitch. They just need to maintain what they're doing now. And you know, fans can obviously argue over this greatest of all time stuff, but it makes no difference, to be honest. Yeah, they're the best team by a country mile in England this year.
And a decent text in here. This one's for you, Damien. Afternoon, lads. Can you ask Damien if he ever played with anyone who was a passionate supporter of another club, or do players keep it hidden? And this, it says, is from a former Douglas Hall teammate. No name attached, though.
Absolutely, players are fans, you know. I remember going to, remember playing at Crystal Palace with Scott Dan, and he was a massive Liverpool fan. And Danzy always used to, not always, but he regularly used to score against Everton and Liverpool. And he used to like say that when he get back on the bus, all his family were Everton fans, but he was a Liverpool fan. So when he scored against Everton, like, you know, his family would be like texting him, giving him grief and stuff. But he was a huge Liverpool fan. And I remember I think we beat Liverpool at Anfield. I think it was Klopp's first defeat when he first got the job in 2015, maybe. And Danzy scored the winner with about 10 minutes left. And he was kind of laughing afterwards. He was kind of sitting there, you know, not disappointed, you know what I mean? But he was kind of saying, you know, he wasn't ecstatic, let's just put it that way. But, you know, he beat Liverpool and he was a Liverpool fan.
Would you have ever been in a situation where maybe players' allegiances to other teams were kind of being brought up and put to them, maybe if they played particularly bad against them?
No, nothing like that. You know, you trust it when players get to that level, that the professionalism, doesn't matter who they're playing against. They'll always give their best and stuff, but it was usually just a bit of crack afterwards on the bus. You know, if someone had a poor game, like, and you knew that they were a Liverpool fan or whatever, like, you give them a bit of a going over, like, you know, saying that you never played well against Liverpool and whatnot. But usually it was the other way around. You know, if you scored against a team you supported, it was always just a bit of crack on the bus afterwards.
I imagine then on the flip side as well, you probably would have played with players down the years who would have been fans growing up of the team they were currently at as well. And would you actually see how it probably did mean a little bit more to them?
Yeah, maybe not. I don't think so. No, I never, not anything I ever picked up on. I always thought that, you know, players were ultra professional and did the best they could do, you know, because once you get to a certain level, if you have that type of weakness in your mentality and stuff, or you have that type of, those types of thoughts, you get kind of weeded out at a very young age and you don't get it. But if you get to a certain level, you know, you are a winner and you have a good personality and you have a good way about you and you want to win at everything that you want to do. So, you know, it was usually just a bit of jest afterwards as opposed to anything else.
Another text in here as well. As regards Liverpool doing a Leicester, they're 20-plus points clear off the back of a 97-point season last year, including a Champions League win. And also, Dan, as well, that texter we'd been discussing before the ad break, wondering whether or not he was referring to Liverpool being the best team ever in the Premier League or just this season. He has texted back and he just said the word ever.
Yeah, that does make a bit more sense. I don't think you can claim they're not the best team in the Premier League this season, to be fair. I people have different views on this. I mean, these are subjective debates, and like, they're great debates, but no one's really right or wrong. Like, best ever teams, I always, in any best ever debate, and I've had this at home or at any league, I think you have to win a couple for me to be in the best ever. You can have a team that's brilliant for a season, but I almost think, you know, you have to win a couple nearly back to back, or have a bit of a dynasty as opposed to like one league. I don't think that's going to be a problem with this Liverpool team. As I said, I think they will win more. So, you know, the debate will be properly had, I think, in the coming years. I just think they need to retain a title before they really enter it, for me. But that's just personal preference. Some people would say, listen, if they have an outstanding season, then, you know, judge them and their legacy on that season alone. But I sort of think, you know, you almost need to dominate a decade to go into that like best ever debate. Like, you associate teams with like an era. Like, you think of Manchester United of the 90s as an era. You probably think of Arsenal in a way, although, I mean, the two of them went toe-to-toe over a period of time. And it's probably City over the last decade in terms of volume of stuff won. I don't think it's going to be a problem with Liverpool, but I think they'll get there. But I think before you crown them as one of the best ever Premier League teams, I think they need to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a fair enough and fairly rational point. Damien, one thing to go back on, and it was something you kind of touched on right at the top of the show, was if Manchester City, for example, now, if they were to lose their appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport and they would be out of European competition for the next couple of years, obviously then there's the danger that they could lose a couple of big players. Like, Kevin De Bruyne has pretty strongly hinted that he would be thinking about things if he wasn't going to be involved in the Champions League for a couple of years. How far are Man City off Liverpool at the moment? And if they were to lose a couple of players like Kevin De Bruyne, how far would they be off them then?
I think Manchester City going into this year, and I think Pep was aware that something like this might happen, that you know, with Vincent Kompany going and the problems he's had at centre-back with Fernandinho, he was aware that it was probably a rebuilding year. And you look at Rodri coming in centre-midfield, it was going to take a year to find his feet. You know, David Silva's last year, you know, it would have been great if he could have won three in a row, but I think that he was kind of using this year as a stepping stone or a building block, to be honest with you, and they'll come back strong next year. The UEFA thing, Pep's the one they need to worry about, because all the players are under contract and there'll be no clauses in there or anything like that, you know, that they can leave as long as the club pay them. And I think their pockets are deep enough where they still will be able to pay the current players. And once they pay them, it doesn't matter how much of a fuss they want to kick up, they can keep them. And they'll certainly be under no pressure to sell them. So if someone, Kevin De Bruyne, says, I would think about leaving if I didn't get Champions League football, the club could slap a £200 million price tag on him. And, you know, if they could get someone to pay that, that'd be great. So I think the players are all locked up nice and tight, but the manager could always resign or could make, you know, could walk out or could quit or whatever it may be. Then you'd have a difficult job acquiring a top, top, top level manager without the lure of Champions League football for two seasons. And then if you bring in a manager that's not a massive personality, that's not, you know, the king of the castle, so to speak, you know, a lot of players there could run riot. It could be difficult for them. So it would be the manager leaving and who they could attempt to take a job. Now, you'd always get a manager to take a job with the money that Manchester City have. But would they be able to get an elite manager who Manchester City obviously would need to have to compete and win leagues in England?
Dan, it is going to be really interesting to see what happens with that Court of Arbitration for Sport appeal.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I guess I haven't studied the case in huge level of depth, but certainly there is no doubt that UEFA need to look at this broader issue seriously. And I think we're so used in football, and in fact a lot of sports really, that we're used to an initial harsh punishment that eventually gets rolled back on appeal. We come to expect it. We come to think that that's going to happen. And as a result, as a result, nothing changes. And I have a big issue. I don't like, the divide between the top super clubs and everyone else. I don't like, but fear it's inevitable. And I didn't once believe it was inevitable, but I feel it's inevitable that they're going to use their power, if not to get to a Super League, but to a sort of a very different Champions League that sort of excludes, the second tier, third tier teams. And I'm not mad on that personally, but for the competitiveness of the Premier League in the short term, I can understand why people would be hopeful that City aren't punished, purely because I think they are the only real viable rival. But listen, if the rules are clear and they can't prove their case, well then they should pay the penalty for that. And it's not exactly an ownership structure you'd feel too sympathetic for if it came to pass. But I think that's the problem. I think there is no doubt that the problem with City, the obvious defensive issues, there is that small, just that their players are just aging in certain areas. Like Silva's at the end of the road, and if they were to be subject to a ban, I'm sure someone like De Bruyne, and these players who are getting to that 28, 29 territory, suddenly wonder, well, these are big years in their career. They're big earning years in their career. Okay, they'll get the money, but big achieving years in their career as well. Do they want to be out of the Champions League? And even someone like Sterling, who's elite now. So that is the key probably to the next couple of title races, is that case. I mean, there's no other way to avoid it. Like, I still think on a given 11v11 on a day, Man City are well capable of beating Liverpool. There's no doubt, but they're nowhere near at the level to have that application across the season. And that's why Liverpool have completely blitzed it. And City, for whatever reason, those deficiencies that are there in the squad, the aging, maybe just the loss of loss of that intensity and focus, we've seen it. We've seen the points that they've dropped across the year that they wouldn't have dropped last year in that brilliant title race. I wouldn't be shocked on a given day if they beat Liverpool, if they all clicked, but they're not consistent enough.
Dan, I have a question for you there, right? I mean, Manchester City have been, found guilty of bringing the financial fair play rules, but they're still in the European competition. And theoretically, they could go on and win the competition this year, Manchester City. And if they won it and the ban is upheld, should they be allowed to keep their Champions League? Because it's almost like they've cheated, got the gains from it, and you're going to get banned in the future. They broke it for the last two seasons. I mean, surely they should be thrown out of the competition.
Well, look, and this is...
be scratched from the
It's a fair point. I mean, I guess you see, you go down that road, and where do you stop? Rampant losses in football are completely tolerated, and people talk about sort of fair play and rules, and we've seen how teams have obviously done it. We've seen it with PSG and whatever. It's how you define your sponsorship and your investment relative to the rules, and there's an element of a nod and wink about a lot of stuff. And I can't imagine they want to go down the road of retrospectively taking away titles that have been won, even if it's, say, a title. I know what you're saying about this year's title and one that's ongoing at the moment, but I think they have to go down. You almost end up going back through your own record books then on stuff that you've done. It's a valid talking point. I'm sure the point will be raised. I'm sure UEFA are dreading it, because I think there's every chance they're very capable of winning it. I'm sure that's going to be their focus now. But I think to go down the road of punishing them and kicking them out of the competition in a strange way, exposes UEFA's weakness on this previously and probably opens up another can of worms from them that I don't think they will do. They say, here is our prescribed rules for punishment. They operate going forward, and this is what happens, because they allow teams almost to break the rules and then they punish them afterwards. And that's what happens in football generally. You see, in the Championship in England, they've started to finally punish teams a bit, but only belatedly.
But it's cheat down. It's cheating, essentially. I mean, it's cheating. So, yeah. You know, what a sport, some may be accused of cheating, yet they're allowed to continue. If you look at any cheat, if it's, and I know it's drug cheating as opposed to financial cheating, but they've gained an unfair advantage when other teams have been, you know, adhering by the rules and trying to work their ass off to try and stay within the financial fair play rules. And if Manchester City have just flagrantly, if they have just flagrantly just kind of tossed the rules to one side and they go on to win the competition, I mean, surely they should be taken out of the competition until the case is heard. And if they're found guilty, then they get a ban. But if they're found innocent, then, well, you get reinstated in the competition. I know that's extremely difficult, but, like, it is cheating in my book. And if they win it, and I agree with you, UEFA would be absolutely dreading the fact that they win it, because, you know, it means that cheating is rewarded.
I think you have to let them stay. You have to let them stay in it until the appeal is heard. I just, like, they have to stick with that. But listen, it raises massive questions. Like, there is absolutely no doubt about that. It's just my suspicion that I can't see UEFA wanting to do that because of the counterclaims that possibly could be made. They've let them come this far in the competition. Like, if you're going to do that, what about the teams they've taken points off, the teams they've knocked out, the teams, like, it throws the whole competition into disarray if you make a call like that during it. Like, they've been allowed to play in the competition at the start of the year, and they probably have to let them see it out on that basis. But I mean, that's why they would love if they were just knocked out at the next stage and they don't have to face this dilemma, because people will share your opinion. I can see probably weighing it up on the basis of what causes the most problems. They have to almost let them play it out because they've let them go this far and see what happens. But people will very strongly make the view that you're making. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. Right, guys, we'll move on from Liverpool and, I suppose, the knock-on of Manchester City as well. We'll come close to home. Dan, it's obviously been a fairly busy week, as each of the last few weeks have been with the League of Ireland. And whether or not we're going to get a season back up, when we're going to get a season back up. You were writing yesterday about Plan B with the compromise that was being discussed of a possible 12-team Premier Division next season, which that seems to have been shut down as well. What is the latest over the last few days? Because I think every time I check your Twitter page, something seems to have changed.
Yeah, I mean, I think for those of us who've been sort of working this over the last couple of weeks, we're sort of operating in a bit of a parallel universe to the project restart and all of that, because, you know, and there's people invested in it, and there's players and you know, managers and staff and fans here at home who are just totally frustrated and annoyed that it's become so complicated to try and factor a return to the pitch. I mean, previously, you know, of course, the main reason that people weren't coming back and we're talking about not coming back was very viable health concerns and you know fears about, well, there's going to be no fans allowed in games at all. We're going to have to play all our matches in neutral venues because we can't have teams, you know, we can't be opening, you know, all the different grounds and so on and so forth. And, you know, while I didn't agree with it, I could appreciate the argument against not coming back because of how diminished and complicated it would be. Now, what we've seen now is, you know, touch wood, a feeling of confidence around the safety of a return to play. We've seen an improved financial package offered, which was obviously crucial. And I think that state relief coming through was underpinning that improved package. And yet now we're bogged down in a row around the format and the return to play. And there is no doubt that the self-interest of all 19 clubs is shaping their particular opinion on what should happen. And that's probably inevitable, because the history of football in this country here is that, you know, everyone is suspicious of everyone else. Everyone is fighting their own patch because there's no collective strength there, no collective sort of commercial TV deals there gives everyone a degree of security. So everyone's looking out for themselves. And, you know, we've had discussions in the last while here about, you know, should the clubs break away from the FAI, say. What we're seeing now is that it's very hard to see that working in Ireland because our clubs all want different things. So what we have in the situation, just to break it down for people, is that you have a broad agreement that the league will restart and that the season this year will be 18 games in length. That includes four or five games already played. That's broadly agreed, although Dundalk and one or two other clubs would like a longer season. They don't think a champion should be crowned over that length of time, and I can certainly see that point of view. 18 games is very unsatisfactory. The reason it won't be any longer is that most clubs don't want, even though we've lost a lot of football, most clubs don't want to play beyond October. Or late October, start of November, because that involves paying extra money. And I mean, that's clubs, but it's also players as well who in one hand, they could, yeah, there's an argument you extend it to December and they earn the same money over a longer period of time. But unfortunately, a lot of players in this country, they make money in other ways over the winter, or the situation of, you know, drawing down social welfare payments over the winter and then getting paid for football for 40 weeks for those clubs. It's not a bad case for some of them. They have other things going on in their lives. So what we have is really two options on the table now. One is that we have two 10-team leagues at the moment, and that the team that finishes bottom of the Premier Division is automatically relegated and the champions of the First Division is automatically promoted. Some clubs wanted a playoff for the bottom team, but it seems that the option now is one-on-one. The alternative option is that, yeah, we have 12 teams in the Premier Division next year. Without giving a long-winded version of it, it just means that the First Division champions are automatically promoted and there will be a playoff series involving the bottom two in the Premier, the top, the second and third in the First Division. Three of them would get a top flight place out of it. So possibly no Premier teams will be relegated at all. I like that one because there will be extra football matches to solve dilemmas, and my view is that they're football clubs that should play football games, and this season is a bit of a write-off, but at least giving some drama later in the year would be good. The counterpoint is a 12-team league is a bit of a shambles going forward because there's massive inequality, how do you fix that going forward? So yeah, I can understand why people would tune out of that broader debate. The fact is clubs can't agree on what to do. The FAI wrote to them the other day and said, if you don't agree, we're going to impose the format. It's getting to the stage now where I can't see the 19 clubs reaching an agreement. So the FAI are just going to have to make a decision and show some strong leadership. But whatever they do, they will make some people unhappy. And that is going to be the next phase of this story, unfortunately.
Should the FAI have stepped in a little bit earlier with that, if you can't figure out what you want to do, we're going to decide for you? Like, it feels like we kind of should have had an agreement on this quite a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, they probably should have, but they probably couldn't do that when the package they were offering financially wasn't very good. So it would have been hard for them to step in then and say, as they have now, that if you don't return, you will be relegated.
So they didn't have the leverage, really, like.
Not really, no. And there was a lot of stuff said in various meetings that that created stories around it. And look, at one suggestion, at one point, there was a feeling that there might even be no repercussions if you opted against playing. Now, I know that was disputed by people, but there's no doubt that that was mentioned and discussed in various talks that happened. But that creates a situation where then you have no incentive to come back and play. And that struck me as bizarre, as a bizarre approach. And that now isn't in place. And I think that's correct. I think, you know, clubs who don't want to come back and play at the moment, I think the financial package that's on offer seems to be reasonable enough. I appreciate that this is a tough time for everyone and people are going to suffer. They're going to suffer financial hardship of some kind. What they needed to do was limit that. I think the package that's there now with the prospect of fans coming back gives people a chance. And then you're into the territory of, well, hang on, what type of self-interest are we talking about here? Is it just a fear of relegation that is stopping teams from coming back? And that point has been made, and they have to accept it. Now, that point can be, as I said, that can be thrown at every team arguing something here. But as time goes on, I do think the view has come to the fore that we need to restore a season. Like every other league in Europe that is in a summer season is either back playing or has a date. we don't really, like, we're not anywhere near that at the moment. Sorry, we are near it, but we weren't anywhere near it a couple of weeks ago when all those leagues were in that position. I think we will get it actually resolved in the next couple of days, as much as it's going to be fractious. But the fact it's taken this long to get here is because of years of historic dysfunction. Like, we are just not equipped to deal with something like this because of so much that is wrong with our league that's been exposed by this. And you sometimes try and find the glass half full scenario from it, and I'm struggling. But I guess one way of looking at it is that, you know, it's been such a drawn out story in the public eye that it has exposed how everyone is looking out for themselves in this league. And it should be the need to instigate a debate, to pull people together and go, we can't, God forbid, if we have something like this happening again, that they can't be this divided. But they are. And there's a lot of different factions, a lot of personality clashes, a lot of suspicion, and no real resolution. And the FAI have to show strong leadership, but they also don't have the credit in the bank probably to apply that. And that's something that they have to address as well too.
Damien, how much are you looking forward to getting back to Turner's Cross at some point in 2020?
Yeah, look, I think the FAI need to step in now. I don't know, I take your point there that it was maybe they should have stepped in sooner, but we didn't really have a plan of, you know, what was going to happen with sports events and stuff. But I think if you leave League of Ireland clubs, and my experience with them is they can't, clubs aren't going to agree on anything. You know, the FAI need to show some real strong leadership now, implement a format, implement, results, be that relegation, promotion, and get a product back on the pitch, because that's all anybody really wants at the moment. And if it requires them upsetting a lot of football clubs, because I know there are a lot of clubs won't want to come back because they'll start paying players again, it might be behind closed doors, financially it could be catastrophic for all them. But the FAI need to step in now and make a decision. And I think, Dan, are we middle of July, I think, is when it's mooted to come back. So
July 31st, but you know, it's something, yeah.
Yeah, but they need to come in now and then just, you know, something, and get us playing again, and get fans in. Because if we missed out on a year of football in Ireland here, you might lose a lot of fans. You know, I'm not saying the league would finish, but like, you might not get a lot of people back. There might be a lot of disinterest in it. I don't know, but they need to get something back, because we can't afford to not have a League of Ireland for a season.
Yeah, it's a good point. Like, there certainly are, while there is a very, like, a real core League of Ireland support, there probably are quite a few very, very passive fans that'll come in and out of the league, and you know, longer it's off the table, the less chance of them coming back is as well. We're going to have to take a quick ad break here just to run you through some of the scores in the Championship. Around five of the games were played this morning, or early this afternoon. The results there: Charlton 1, QPR 0. Cardiff 3-1 winners away to Preston, so they've actually replaced Cardiff in the playoff spots at the moment. They're up to sixth place. Preston have dropped down to eighth. For the time being, at least. Luton Town 1-0 winners against Swansea. James Collins, Republic of Ireland international, scoring for Luton there. Barnsley and Millwall finished scoreless. Derby County 2-1 winners against Reading. And the 4-3 o'clock kickoffs are just past the hour mark at the moment, around 25 minutes left in them. Hull City 3-2, they lead away to Birmingham City. Leeds on course to go 3 points clear at the top. They are 2-0 up against Fulham, taking advantage of West Brom's defeat to Brentford last night. Middlesbrough, with Neil Warnock in charge, he is set for a win in his first game as manager. 2-0 they lead away to Stoke City. So Middlesbrough would be climbing up to 19th place in the table as things stand. And then Blackburn and Wigan are still scoreless. A win for Blackburn would see them edge up to within 1 point of the playoff spot. Still plenty more coming up though, with Dan and Damien on Off the Ball after the break.
Missing this?
I remember Ollie texted me, Solskjaer. One or two people would get hold of my number, unfortunately, and he would text me.
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoff and Heskey.
Hi, you're welcome back to Off the Ball. Neil Tracy here with you until 5 o'clock this evening into the final 20 minutes of OTB Football Saturday, where Dan McDonnell and Damien Delaney are joining me. We're streaming at the moment across all of our social channels. You can get us at Off the Ball. You can also text us 53106 so you can watch us and listen to us live on the OTB Sports app. Plenty of texts coming in and still a lot of them on Liverpool as well. If Van Dijk got a long-term injury, Liverpool would be screwed, says one texter. How could you even compare the Manchester United team who won the treble to any team over the last 20 years? This Liverpool side won't win it next year. They may be lucky to end up in the top two or three. How many games was this so-called best team lucky to win matches? How many times, if you look back, did they get a penalty they shouldn't have? This is a Leicester team, a one-off, says an unnamed texter. And another text in then along the same lines. You're talking about teams beating this team and that team. Leicester won it by playing good football. That was a one-off, and I'd say Liverpool will be the same. Not to the fact they won't be in the top three or four, but Chelsea, Manchester United, with the players they'll bring in this window, will push Liverpool all the way. And a last one, just to go back on what Damien was, what we were talking about, Liverpool or Man City and their appeal for the Court of Arbitration for Sport for their European ban. Lads, if City have been financially doping, surely their Premier League win last season was very tainted, says Paulie M. And I suppose that goes along the lines of what rugby fans would have seen this season with Saracens relegated from the Premiership, and a lot of people wondering, should they have been punished for, you know, their Champions Cup last season stripped? But it didn't happen, and it seems that's the way Man City's is going as well. One story I want to talk about, guys, and I mentioned it just before the break. Middlesbrough 2-0 up on Stoke City at the moment. Neil Warnock back in charge. And obviously the knock-on effect of that with Jonathan Woodgate leaving was that Robbie Keane was also gone from Middlesbrough. So he's probably in a bit of a limbo as to what he's doing. We'll talk about Robbie Keane in just a couple of minutes, though, because I want to ask you, Damien. Neil Warnock is a character a lot of people tend to either love or hate. You would have worked with him for a brief spell at Crystal Palace. What's Neil Warnock like?
God, he's what's the best way to describe him? No, he's an old-fashioned manager.
Remember, we're on live radio now, by the way, as well.
I know, yeah. he's an old-fashioned manager, and I just feel there's a lot of players kind of struggled with his methods. Well, at Crystal Palace anyway, because I know he went out to Cardiff and done brilliant. But he tends to kind of garner this underdog, you know, polish up a kind of ragtag bunch and, you know, lots of days off with him. And he's one of those managers who gets players in a good mood, gets them happy. You know, you could play a game on a Saturday and he could come in and he'd say, right, lad, I'll see you all Thursday. And, you know, we were kind of going, well, no, because we're going to get relegated. We wanted to come in and work and stuff like that. So that's how we kind of dealt with him, but I can see how he does well. You know, he gets players that are maybe castaways at other clubs and stuff, loves them, tells them the right things, you know, makes them feel good about themselves, and he does really well in the Championship.
Is he a tactically minded manager, or is he more so just about the man management and motivation?
No, there was no real tactics, you know, to be honest with you. It was just man management, motivation. Wanted to be a happy group. You know, I mean, there was times there where he'd come in, the training would be starting at 10:30, and his car would come in at like 10:25, and he'd just kind of walk out onto the training pitch in his jeans and his shirt, and he'd have a couple of, you know, it was a little bit like old school like that, and that was his way. And he'd throw out a couple of cones, and he'd say, let's have a five-a-side, and he'd have some games and Mars bar, and just got a good general feeling in the camp. And I think in the Championship, that's really, really good, because it's very, very full on. You don't need to train that hard because you're playing so many games. It's just about keeping everyone positive, keep everyone happy, and I think that's why he does really, really well in the Championship. Whereas, you know, for us in the Premier League, we were getting beat fairly regularly, and teams were tactically, you know, outmaneuvering us, and, you know, we were losing games, and he was coming in and having the crack and all that, and I think a lot of lads were just kind of getting a little bit despondent, to be honest with you. So that's why his time in charge of Palace was so short.
Mm-hmm. He'd been there, obviously, and had done a lot better a few years previously prior to when you'd been there. Dan, where do you sit on Neil Warnock here? Because I know in Off the Ball Towers, there's a handful of us here, and like we actually love him. He's great entertainment. He's great value for money.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a colourful football history. I see Kevin Blackwell as his assistant, has come in as assistant, who from speaking to people who've worked with him closely, would they wouldn't have been enamoured with him at times. Yeah. And I think sometimes with these old school managers, there is a Marmite element to them, and Warnock almost
proper football men, Dan.
Yeah, well, you know, fitting a certain image of a football man, all right. And I think, you know, Warnock trades off it, though. I mean, that's his thing. And, like, in fairness, whatever your opinion, like, the longevity of his career is incredible. Like, Mick McCarthy spoke about him recently and sort of admiring him for... Because is he 17 now, Warnock? I'm not sure what age he is, but he might be in that parish. So when you consider how many people drop out of the game, people who would have been, you know... of his generation, who would have obviously been far better players and viewed as more studious football men or whatever, and they haven't been able to survive in the industry for as long as he had. So it's incredible. I mean, they've gone in now to Stoke away today, which is a massive game. It's a pretty straightforward Warnock type of job here. Just, you know, keep us up, basically. And like Stoke are a rival that have been in good form. If Middlesbrough go there and win, they might only need one or two more performances like that to be safe, and it's job done. He doesn't even need to do anything else there, whether he does or not. But I haven't worked with him, so I don't know. I'm going off secondhand impressions, but I know people have worked with Blackwell closely, and you know, because I would have worked with Keith Gillespie on his book a while back, and he would have been under Warnock and Blackwell at Sheffield United as a team, and he's very much. He's very much in tune with every aspect of English football, the transfer market, how it operates, everything. He knows the system well, but he knows how to manage it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to you were saying around 70, 71 years of age. He'll be 72 in December. He is got his first managerial job in 1980, so 40 years ago. And they are still 2-0 up away to Stoke City with just over 10 minutes plus.
I could picture him going into that Middlesbrough changing room like this week, you know, a relegation battle, and just walking in full of the joys of life and just old school battering players, having a bit of banter with them, telling them they're, you know, useless, what's the matter, why you got a smile on your face, Jesus, things aren't that bad. And that weight of his personality, you know, would have put a smile on a lot of players' faces. You know, he would have been having a go at players in a jokey kind of way. And he's good for that. He really is. And he's full of personality, full of life. And he's done ever so well to be still managing at the age that he is. And to go into another championship job. And don't be surprised next year if Middlesbrough get promoted from the championship.
Yeah. And actually, just going back on how age is just a number, like Roy Hodgson, another of your old Crystal Palace managers, 73 years of age. And they've been absolutely flying this season.
Yeah, he's... I don't know how. I mean, I had a year working with him, and it was probably the most enjoyable year of my career. And I didn't play for him that much, but he was such a fabulous man. And I suppose that the weight of the experience that he has, the deals with players, the way he treats people, the way he speaks to people, the respect that he has for his players. If you're, you know, the club captain or you're a first year professional, he treats everyone the exact same way. If you've got an issue, you can go and speak to him. And he has a lovely way about him, and you know, he'll tell you why he thinks a certain way or why he did what he did. You might not agree with him, but he gets across in such an eloquent way that you can't argue with him. And you know, for him to do that at 73, and there's talk he's going to get another year next year as well. You know, it's fantastic, to be honest with you.
Would you have a few fears though that whenever he does decide, you know, if he says on a year, whenever he does decide to call it a day and retire from football management, that because he's had such a big influence over these last few years, that Crystal Palace could actually have a really, really difficult time for a couple of years? Because it's something we would have seen with a lot of clubs down the years.
Yeah, and that's definitely a valid point, because he molds a team to exactly what he wants. You know, he works on it every day. I mean, training with him can be very, very monotonous, very, very repetitive. It's small team shape, defensive structure, and he just drills it into you, you know, 60 minutes a day, you know, and you might get like 2 minutes of five-a-side at the end of a bit of enjoyment, you know. And if I remember, always players would be like complaining, "Oh no, come on, can we have another 2 minutes of games?" And he'd say stuff like, you know, five-a-sides are only good for picking up bad habits. You know, you guys will do things in these five-a-sides that you wouldn't do on a Saturday, so I'm not going to let you pick up bad habits. So he'd let you have two-minute games or even two 1-minute games, and then he'd call the whole thing off, and he'd just say, well, "No discipline, you know." Work rate and concentration. So when he leaves and another manager comes in, because he has such a special way about him, it's very, very difficult for another manager to get the same out of a group of players, because they wouldn't have the same affinity for the new manager, or they possibly wouldn't, than they would for Roy, because Roy is so respectful to the players that, like, if you don't do your job or you make a mistake, he doesn't actually say anything to you. You genuinely feel bad because he's such a good guy that you genuinely feel like you let him down. That's kind of his MO or his management, really, is he just kind of gets in a player's soul and players don't want to let him down.
Mm-hmm. Dan, to come back to, I drifted away from Middlesbrough there, but just to come back to it, obviously, Robbie Keane has left Middlesbrough now. He's, I suppose, still trying to figure out what is happening. I think we all are still trying to figure out what is happening with the FAI. Is that a bit of a crossroads?
Yeah, I mean, it's not been a great run for him, really, you know, with the Ireland thing, you know, working out the way it did, and this Middlesbrough situation. He'd only signed a one-year deal at Middlesbrough, and I think that was possibly tied in with the fact that he was meant to take a bigger role with the FAI after Euro 2020, but this was something that was from an old contract. Well, no, it's his current contract, but a contract handed to him by John Delaney at a different time, basically given to him before the succession plan, I think, was really formulated. So I've spoken about this before. I think it was only right that Stephen Kenny picked his own staff. I don't think anyone can really complain with that. It's just obviously a big problem that you know, Robbie Keane is there in a quite substantial contract, and there's no role for him, it seems, realistically, from a football perspective, at a time when Irish football isn't in great nick. And from my understanding, they haven't really made any progress with that since April of any great degree. And I think there's an element of probably trying to find an amicable conclusion that it is amicable, because I'm sure Robbie Keane wants to manage Ireland one day, and I don't think anyone wants to be sort of burning bridges or being involved in a public dispute with someone who's been such a big player for the country. But at the same time, he has a contract and you have to work it out. And yeah, the fact that now he has no options with Middlesbrough, you know, presents him with a challenge. I mean, my view on it now is that, like, Robbie Keane is 40 next month. He's got his pro license there yesterday. Okay, he hasn't got extensive coaching experience. He's only had the year at Middlesbrough and that time with Ireland, but it is getting to the stage where he probably needs to get out there and show what he's about as a manager. Because, I mean, other than a player manager stint for one game in India, I don't think he's ever actually, like, managed a team at any level. And maybe he just needs to go out there and show what he could do. And he clearly wants to get back to Ireland someday, no doubt, the Ireland role, but he's not going to get that opportunity without more of a CV as a sort of a coach or a manager. The days of, like, you know, his playing career is gone now, and it's about how he proves himself in this other sphere. And I don't know where that will take him now. Like, he's still a big name, and I'm sure he'll get opportunities. They might be overseas, and it's going to be about probably proving himself in this next stage of a career, because you've got to be careful, I think, as an assistant sometime, that he has to build the experience. But, like, if you know, there's no doubt that, like, the fact that Middlesbrough didn't do well, it doesn't look great for Woodgate and Keane. And if he goes as number two somewhere else and that doesn't work out, like, you know, he's not really in control of his own destiny. So he probably needs to get on that ladder somewhere, because I did make the point in the piece, like, management is sort of a younger man's game now. And you have to get on the ladder and, like, prove yourself quickly. And I think if that's his ambition, that's where he's going to have to explore opportunities rather than going in with someone else. But there's no doubt, I'm sure he'll be motivated to do it, but he's going to have to present that challenge now.
Mm-hmm. Guys, we're fast running out of time. We probably only have about maybe 2 minutes of chat left. One little aspect I just wanted to mention as well. Obviously, Jeff Hendrick's situation cropped back up this week when it was confirmed he was going to be leaving Burnley. We've had all these links with Italy, like Roma and AC Milan were both mentioned, and it kind of has seemed maybe that the AC Milan one had a bit more legs than we actually initially thought. But regardless of where he goes, whether it's Italy or whether it's a Championship team or a Premier League team, it's a crucial move for him at this stage of his career, isn't it?
I don't think Jeff would have made the decision to not take up the contract offer at Burnley unless he had something lined up. And he's obviously got something that he fancies lined up. Be it at a better level, or be it at a higher level, or somewhere where he's going to get a chance to play regularly, or he feels in a system that will suit him more, regularly in a system that will suit him more than what Burnley does. I don't know, but I know that Jeff obviously is a smart guy, and he definitely has a plan. So it'll be interesting to see where he winds up. The AC Milan Jeff Hendrick strolling over at AC Milan, that'd be fantastic. But I'm pretty sure he has got something lined up.
And Dan?
Yeah, no, he's in a great position this summer. Like, he's 28. Like, there's obviously a view of Jeff Hendrick in Ireland that's shaped by the fact that he hasn't played that well for Ireland in the last couple of years. But he started more games than he did for Burnley this year. He's an established Premier League player, and he's available as a free agent in a post-pandemic transfer market that clubs aren't going to spend that much. I think at the, you know, below the top clubs will still spend loads. And that's why the Milan link was definitely genuine, because they're looking around. People who play Championship Manager, they put in that that filter for free agents that are available. And Jeff Hendrick comes up as someone who's played a lot at a good level. So he is, I think he's waiting to see how the relegation thing pans out in the Premier League. That'll show what he's fully got available. But he could have stayed at Burnley if he wanted. And I agree with Damien. Like, he knows he's in a good position, and who knows, there may be something in mind. But he'll be fine. He'll end up in a good place wherever he goes.
Dan, Damien, pleasure as always. Thanks a million for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Neil.
Thanks, lads.
That's Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent and former Republic of Ireland international. Damien Delaney with us on OTB Football Saturday. And that's where we have to wrap things up here on Off the Ball. Just to bring you back up to date with a bit of housekeeping business. Results from the Championship. Not quite results yet, but heading deep into injury time. Now 3-3 between Birmingham and Hull. Leeds are 3-0 up on Fulham, so they are going to go 3 points clear at the top of the table. Middlesbrough 2-0. They lead 88 minutes on the clock away to Stoke City, who are falling back into a bit of trouble in the Championship table down towards the bottom, while Wigan 1-0 up on Blackburn Rovers, those local rivals meeting. Also, 5:30, the FA Cup game today, Norwich against Manchester United. Team news is in for that. So Manchester United made plenty of changes. They've Romero in goals, Shaw, Maguire, Bailly and Dalot at the back, Fred and McTominay in midfield, with Jesse Lingard, Bruno Fernandes and Juan Mata behind Odion Ighalo, while Norwich go Akrul in goals, and the rest of their team: Ahrens, Godfrey, Klose, Lewis, Tete, McLean, Rupp, Buendia, Cantwell and Timu Pukki up front. But that's where we have to leave you for Off the Ball today. Joe will be back tomorrow afternoon, where we will have the Sunday paper review, as always, at 1:30. Maura Trasny-Callig and Brendan O'Brien will be joining us. We'll be playing you some of Keith Wood's State of the Union, a referees panel with John Lacey and Jerome Garces, and also Premier League commentary, Watford versus Southampton at 4:15. But from us here this Saturday on Off the Ball, thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you tomorrow.
For the perfect pass, give him a ball and he had a spice. He'll give you a move with gold-like eyes.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.